Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. What do you think of when you put St. Louis and the movies in the same sentence? To some, it would be the film Meet Me in St. Louis. To others, it might mean Betty Grable or Shelley Winters or John Goodman or John Hamm, all homegrown stars. Some may point to such films as Up in the Air, White Palace, or Escape from New York. There are a lot of dots that can be connected between our area and the movies. There are also some disconnected dots that could be costing our area and the state some revenue. I'm Don Marsh. We're talking about it all on today's program. And joining me in studio, Carrie Houck of Houck Casting is a casting director and a former president of the Missouri Film Commission. Joni Tackett, also a casting director, is president of the Missouri Motion Media Association, a film lobbying group. Cliff Frelick is executive director of Cinema St. Louis, an organization which promotes film as an art form in St. Louis and runs the St. Louis International Film Festival. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I'll go right around the table with the same question, if I may. And Joni, I'll start with you. What is the first thing you think of when you make the connection between St. Louis and the movies?
Well, I would say for me, since I am the current president of Missouri Motion Media Association, I'm always thinking, why don't we have more movies shooting in St. Louis? So that's the first thing that comes to mind for me, because our organization is working hard all across the state to unify our production community and to get an incentive started again at the state level.
We'll talk in more detail about that. It has been a problem for drawing business into town. Carrie Houck, how about you?
Well, and I do want to clarify, I was a consultant and interim director of the St. Louis Film Commission.
I beg your pardon.
That's okay.
Bad information.
No,
heads,
it's okay.
Will roll.
I guess what I look at it as a major part of my past career. I am working on a film now, but when I moved to St. Louis, I had constant work for movie making. And in the last 5 years, maybe even a little longer, it's really tapered off. So I now mostly coach actors. I do still cast. And now I'm producing a play. And I'm really back in my theater roots more than I had been for years.
Theater is pretty healthy in St. Louis.
Oh, that's, and it's really thriving. Yeah.
That's great to hear that, mm-hmm. Yeah. Cliff, how about you?
Well, as a former film critic, I obviously default to seeing movies as opposed to helping make movies. And Meet Me in St. Louis, obviously, is the film that most St. Louisans are going to associate with town. And it's obviously looked on with great fondness by everyone in town, but it's also a great film. It's really an extraordinary work. And although it wasn't shot here, it was shot on an MGM backlot, nonetheless, it's a great representation, I think, of what people would like to think of as St. Louis, even though it may not actually be the case.
But when you run down the list of movies that were shot here, mm-hmm. it's a pretty considerable list.
It is, although not all are equally fine. There are some really terrific films made here, including most recently, obviously, Up in the Air. But the best film, in my estimation, that was shot here is King of the Hill, which is a truly extraordinary work, and I think is not recognized as much as it should be because it's been long unavailable. It was released on VHS tape, which no one can even play anymore, and then it wasn't on DVD for many, many, many years. It's only recently been put out on a beautiful quality Blu-ray from the Criterion Collection. So it's now, I think, going to get much more attention paid.
And it's from the book by A.E. Hotchner, who is also a St. Louisan.
That's correct. It's a memoir. It's fictionalized, but it's essentially his story.
Carrie Houck, you worked that film, didn't you?
I did. And in my 34-year career, that was my favorite project all around. The producers have become my dear friends. Steven Soderbergh was the kind of director a casting director loves to work with. He had utter trust in me and created a wonderful atmosphere for the local actors, used a lot of local actors, and it was the summer of my life. He turned Taylor and Olive back in time, and we had hundreds and hundreds of extras that were just period perfect, and we didn't have one bad weather day except for the day we needed rain. We got rain.
I was just gonna bring that up. I'd seen that someplace. Mm-hmm. Casting extras, is that part of what you do as a casting director?
It used to be. I don't do that anymore because I don't have the patience. The movie I'm working on now, I'm doing the speaking parts, and I have hired an assistant to do the extras for me. But God knows I've done a lot of it, as has Joni. And it's hard. It's hard. You need youth and energy and patience.
And a great sense of humor.
Yes.
No, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a movie called Marshall the Miracle Dog, which is adapted from a children's book. It is being shot across the river primarily. We'll have a couple of St. Louis locations because they did get a tax credit from the state of Illinois.
Well, that brings us back to you and your comments early on that this is a problem here. It might have been shot here had we had the proper incentives.
Exactly. I mean, right now there are 41 states that have tax incentives to lure production to their state. And our tax incentive for production work in Missouri ended November 28th, 2013. So officially, we're just not in the game anymore to land any large studio or maybe a television episodic. There's still going to be plenty of independent film, I think, happening here in St. Louis, you know, like what Carrie's working on. I'm working on an independent film right now, too. Those type of projects will still be here. But to land something that has big economic impact, that's what we don't have right now. We're just not able to do that.
What kind of economic impact are we talking about?
Well, for example, on Up in the Air, they spent over $12 million here in the St. Louis region, and therefore they received a tax incentive of $4.1 million. That was basically 35% of the amount that they spent here through labor, resident labor, non-resident labor, and goods and services that were purchased by vendors. And Gone Girl, which shot in Cape Girardeau this past fall, we are expecting that they're going to receive about $2.5 million in incentive, which is actually 25%. They were awarded a different amount, and that's a whole different story. That kind of is a saga that goes on along with the tax incentive. Department of Economic Development has the discretion to decide how much they want to award the production. So it had been written that they could get up to 35%. So they awarded what we project they will, because they haven't finalized their paperwork yet with them, that they're going to get 25%, which meant they spent about $10 million in Cape Girardeau over a seven-week period.
So this deal must have been made before, was it November of 2013?
When you say this deal must have been
for Gone Girl,
yeah. Yes, I believe they were awarded in the summer of 2013. And as long as they were awarded by a certain date, they were able to then shoot. You know, they were told, here's your parameters. And actually, when someone applies for the incentive in the state of Missouri and they were awarded an incentive for production, they were given a time frame. They did not receive the money prior to filming, and that's what a lot of people do not understand about the incentive. So they would be awarded an amount. They then would be told, you have to open a production office by this date, and then you have to complete filming by this date, and then you have to turn in all of your completed paperwork to show the amount of money that you spent. And it's a very long, arduous, audited process that DED then scrutinizes everything they spent in order to give them back what they're requesting to get back that the program says they should receive.
It sounds like the government is involved in this in this process.
Well, it is, and it's basically it's business, and right now we just can't get that business. No. Other states are getting that business.
There is a bill before the legislature now, and the legislative session ends later this week, but in my research, so it hasn't been acted upon. Nothing has happened since March, so
yeah,
it's probably
March
dead.
5th, there was a hearing. It's HB 1451. It was sponsored by Representative Kathy Swan, who's a Republican from Cape Girardeau, because she had a set visit while Gone Girl was there, and she saw the economic impact that Cape Girardeau was receiving. She filed the bill in January, and Missouri Motion Media Association, we showed up for the hearing and spoke in favor of it. It was voted unanimously out of the House Economic Development Committee, but there's been no action since. And I just have to think it's mostly, if you read the papers and you follow what's happening, they just have other priorities this year. And this is an election year, so if nothing happens this year with HB 1451, we're going to try again next year with, you know, a majority of new sure. legislators.
Carrie, were you involved in Up in the Air?
I was not. I was living in Chicago at the time.
You know, one of the things I've heard about that, and perhaps you did too, I heard an interview on NPR with the director of the movie, mm-hmm. said one of the reasons they selected St. Louis was because it had so much empty office space.
Uh-huh. Ouch.
That's a mixed blessing, isn't it?
Well, I did cast Up in the Air, and what I can tell you is that they came here because, yes, there was an incentive. Michael Bugue was the executive producer. He grew up in St. Louis, so that was probably part of him also saying, hey, let's take a look at St. Louis. But, yeah, there was a lot of empty office space at the time because the economy was in such a bad situation. And that was sort of what the movie was about. It was about George Clooney's character being a big downsizer for companies. They would bring him in and he would get rid of people who worked there. So one of the interesting stories, I think, on Jason Reitman and Up in the Air is that many of the people who were in the montage scenes that were being fired, they were actually real people here in St. Louis who had lost their jobs. They had me run an ad in the newspaper and ask for a paragraph describing how someone lost their job and to send their photo in. And it was still, you know, I still think about that process of the casting. It was a delicate balance, to say the least. But then I interviewed people who had lost their jobs. They told the stories of how they lost their job and what they wanted to say to the people who fired him. And he chose some of those real people to come in and actually role play, not with George Clooney, but with one of the producers. And many of them ended up in the film, about 15 of them.
Well, Cliff Fralick, as films go, how did that one stack up in your mind?
Oh, Up in the Air is really, I think, an extraordinary piece of work. Jason Reitman has a very solid career. He's done lots of good work, although I wasn't real fond of his most recent film, Labor Day. But nonetheless, he's done good work consistently throughout his career. And I think Up in the Air was really terrific and also spoke to, I think, the current economic climate mm-hmm. very powerfully. Even though there were humorous moments, there was a lot mm-hmm. of, I think, things that resonated pretty profoundly with anybody who's been through that process of downsizing. I should also mention, I believe, that one of the other attractions of St. Louis, for better or for worse, was the fact that there was an empty airport concourse mm-hmm. That then doubled and tripled as many different airports over the course of the
shoot. Yeah, we were
there
for about 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, how do the actors and actresses and the stars, the upper echelon, if you will, how do they react to St. Louis?
You know, St. Louis is a favorite of almost anyone who's shot here. I don't think people realize how beautiful it is and what charm it has. And for producers, we can double for so many other places. Mm-hmm. When we did Larger Than Life, we doubled for Baltimore, Kansas, New York. We did Manhattan and downtown St. Louis. They switched out
Escape from New York?
This was Larger Than Life with Bill Murray. Oh. And it was a road picture, so they did the whole from the East Coast through Kansas in St. Louis.
Escape from New York, I think much of that was shot in Union Station before it was refurbished, wasn't it?
I was actually an extra in that. And I can be seen. I was one of Isaac Hayes' gypsy girls. That was a long time ago.
Well, but as films go, Cliff, I don't think that was very high on the
actually, John Carpenter, who was the writer-director of Escape from New York, is actually very highly regarded. It's a cultish film. Sure. It's not necessarily a film that is going to be highly regarded by people who are movie snobs, but people who love film, just generally, actually embrace that film quite a bit.
Are you okay with that, Carrie?
I am.
Particularly those gypsy girls. They love
those. Oh, yeah. Remember those scenes very, very well. We've got to take a break. We'll do that now. We're talking about the movies and St. Louis and the many ways in which they are connected. With me in studio is casting director Carrie Houck. Joni Tackett, also a casting director, is with us, the president of the Missouri Motion Media Association. And Cliff Fralick, also with us. He's executive director of Cinema St. Louis. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment, and we'll bring in some other voices as well. So stay with us. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to get into this conversation and give us your best St. Louis memory recollection, we'd love to hear it at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on movies and St. Louis in just a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri lawmakers are trying to resolve differences on legislation dealing with transfer students from unaccredited school districts. House and Senate negotiators will meet this afternoon to seek a compromise between proposals approved by the two chambers. The automaker Tesla is complaining today about legislation pending before Missouri lawmakers. The bill would make it illegal for Tesla, an electric car company, to circumvent car dealerships and sell directly to buyers. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn illegally filled dozens of state jobs that should have been free of politics. That is according to a federal lawsuit. An Associated Press review of documents shows multiple positions were filled by candidates who were politically connected or gave campaign contributions to the governor's party. The administration says the jobs should be exempt from a court ruling prohibiting political hires because they are sensitive policy-making positions. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation on Missouri and St. Louis and the movies. With me in studio, Cliff Frelick, Joni Tackett, and Carrie Houck. Well, is there a favorite movie star, Carrie, that you've worked with?
Oh, well, I would say Bill Murray, maybe. Yeah, he was a prince. He'd buy the extras ice cream. I mean, it was just, he was just a prince. And I had heard terrible things about him before we started shooting. And I didn't see any ill behavior, and he was quite dear.
Some of them can be a real pain in the neck.
Yes, they can.
We'll not mention any names unless you'd like to.
No, I'd rather not.
Joni,
I may have to work with him again.
let's see. I would say George Clooney on Up in the Air. I think what I felt most when I, you know, was on set is that he really was like the, what you would say, old-time Hollywood movie stars. You know, he just has that charisma. He was very nice as well on set. And I think when you have an actor like Bill Murray or you have George Clooney, and they come on set and everyone is relaxed around them because that's the energy they're putting out, it just makes the whole environment just, you know, it's just a fun time to be on set when you have someone that respects everyone else's time as well as, you know, wants their time to be respected. So, yeah.
Cliff, that's really important, isn't it? I mean, the stars, the durable ones, the ones that hang around for a long time generally are pretty good people.
Well, one would hope that's the case, and I trust that in most cases that is, in fact, bears the truth. But I don't know that necessarily everyone qualifies, and particularly I know from a filmmaker point of view, some of the directors that I most admire were actually very unpleasant people like John Ford and Howard Hawks, two great filmmakers, but distinctly unpleasant as human beings on a lot of different levels. So you can't generalize too much. But I think stars, because they have to interact so frequently with other people, at least put on a good front. And even though they may find it objectionable on occasion, they have to be pleasant all the time. They manage to do it because they realize it's sort of part of the job.
Carrie, I've found in my job and talking to a lot of them over the years that it's the young ones, the ones who are just starting, are the most difficult. They think they're already there in so many cases.
You know, I did a movie. It's one of the reasons I don't really like to do extras anymore. It was the last time I did a film with a lot of extras. And I'm not going to mention any actors' names, but it was shot here in the summer, I think it was 10 years ago. Time flies. And there were a lot of young actors in the cast, and a few of them were up and coming. And it was a terrible experience. They would be late every day. I was brought up in the theater, and we could never be late. We would be fired. And we would even be thrown out of class in theater school if we were late. So the work ethic was very poor. And I would rather never. I actually did work with one of them a couple of years later, and things hadn't gotten better. But then there are others. Faye Dunaway. She was a piece of work. She was a piece of work. Yep.
Would you like to be more
specific? In fact, we shot right at the Sheldon. She only came in for the day. She had a big monologue. It was for a miniseries called A Will of Their Own about the women's movement, and it spanned 100 years. So she was a suffragette addressing the crowd. And I had many extras in the audience, and they were so excited. And you know, just looked fantastic. And we were waiting, you know, excitedly for Miss Dunaway. And from the minute they picked her up at the airport, she got in the car. Okay, fellas, I need a pack of cigarettes and a six-pack of Diet Coke. And then she got to her dressing room, wanted all the light bulbs changed. She wanted a steak. It was like 7 in the morning. She wanted a steak from Deerdorf and Hearts, right? They opened the kitchen for her, got her the steak. It was never touched. It was quite a day. And she screamed at everyone in her path.
Oh, well, and whatever happened to Faye Dunaway? She had quite a career, that's for sure, but time does take its toll. Joni, you look like you're getting ready to make a point.
No, I was just thinking that I actually worked with an actor, and I don't want to say who it was, but it was early in his career, and he actually came out on set and yelled at all of the crew to be quiet because he was studying his lines in another room. And then I worked with him again 5 years later after he had become a big movie star, and he was completely gracious to an arena full of boxing fans on a movie I was working on. So he was, he had definitely changed for the better, but it's a very stressful environment at times. You know, it's all about how much they have to film in one day, and the studio has to be happy with it. So there's a lot of pressures, but we always say they probably just weren't raised right. Some of them were, and some of them weren't, just like all of us.
When you're making several million dollars a picture, you know, you probably should play the game, but that's what who am I to say that? Do you guys know Dale Sweet?
Sure.
I don't.
You don't? We're going to get to meet him now,
Carrie.
He is the longtime former manager of the Tivoli Theater in University City. He's going to join us for a couple of moments to talk about the history of this iconic movie house. Dale, are you with us?
I am. Thanks for having me, Don.
Well, it's good to have you. This is an anniversary year for the Tivoli.
It is indeed. The Tivoli opened in 1924, so that makes it the 90th, which nicely shoehorns with the 250th for St. Louis in general.
You know, that surprised me. I had always assumed that the Fox Theater probably was a little bit older than the Tivoli.
And the Tivoli has about 5 years maturity on the Fox, but isn't the oldest theater in town. That would probably be the high point at 1922.
1922.
Oh, for the high point, the Tivoli 24.
That's high point 1920. I'll be darned. Well, I didn't realize it was that old. But I'm learning a lot today, as I often do on this program. The Tivoli has had several different incarnations, if you will, has it not?
It has indeed.
Tell me some of them.
Of course. Well, I mean, it started out as the Tivoli doing movies and vaudeville productions, had an orchestra, had a musical director, had a Kilgan organ, and so on. That changed, of course, with the advent of talking pictures that eliminated some of the accompaniment. Later on in its life, the Tivoli had two other names, a Magic Lantern and the University City Cinema, before becoming the Tivoli again sometime in the late 70s.
Was it a vaudeville house at one time?
Yeah, so from 24 through the time that movies started to talk, talking pictures, the Tivoli did both movies and vaudeville productions. There is a dressing room, dressing rooms, extensive fly space, and rigging and lighting controls and so on, all intact backstage.
And it is on the National Registry of Historic Places.
It is indeed.
You've got a lot of things back there to remind moviegoers of the history of this particular medium. What are some of the memorabilia that you can find at the Tivoli?
When Joe and Linda Edwards renovated the Tivoli in 1995, they installed a lot of one of a kind memorabilia and display cases throughout the theater, including, you know, a plaster Maltese Falcon and so on. One of the most fun things at the Tivoli is that the hallways are lined with movies that all have some kind of St. Louis connection. And Up in the Air is one of them, by the way. And in addition, Joe Edwards spent months pasting together collages from auction catalogs of movies by theme. There's a animated, a murder mystery, a sci-fi, and so on. People come in and ask about where they can purchase the collages, and they're unique in the actual sense of the word.
What kind of business does it do? There is so much competition these days, not only but from other theaters, but from television and Netflix. You name it, there's plenty of competition out there.
Well, the smaller theaters, Don, especially those with, you know, one, two, three screens, live and die on what's on screen. As you mentioned, there's a lot of competition from the internet and Netflix and Redbox and so on, but there are also theaters all over town. It completely depends on the film. One of the biggest times of year at the Tivoli has always been the St. Louis International Film Festival, which I'm sure Cliff talked about a moment ago, that takes place in November. Other huge events are the St. Louis Filmmaker Showcase and 48-Hour Film Project and so on.
Let me see if any members of the folks here in the studio have any questions or comments for you. Anyone want to say hi to Mr. Sweet?
Well, Dale's a longtime friend, and he worked with us at the film festival for many, many years. He's now an attorney, so he's changed his job somewhat. But I have quite fond memories of the Tivoli. I went through the renovation process and did a major piece for the Riverfront Times at the time. But I did all my formative movie going there when the Tivoli was actually a repertory house. They actually used to do five double bills per week. And I would see routinely 8 films a week at the Tivoli. I never quite managed to get to all 10, but it was a beautiful education in film, and it's unfortunately unable to be done here in St. Louis any longer. It just doesn't happen to have a rep house, make it a viable concern.
Carrie, you don't know Dale Sweet, but
I do think we've met, have we, Dale? I believe
we have. Here, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Not at all.
My memory.
it goes.
All I can say is, you know, long live the Tivoli and the High Point. I cannot bear to go to these movie theaters where I might as well be in my den watching at home. I really believe that film should be seen in a theater and with a real screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about you, Jenny?
Yeah, I mean, I think any time that you go to the Tivoli, it is a treat to watch the film there. And like Carrie said, many of the other places, it's just very, I think there's just an informal feel to it. There's a big business feel to it. And those of us who really appreciate the form of filmmaking, it's an art. So to see it in a place like the Tivoli, it just adds to the experience.
Dale, what would that part of our community be without Joe Edwards?
Well, that's really a very good question, Don. The Tivoli's renovation in 1995 was sort of Joe Edwards signaling to the region that the Loop was back. That is, you know, a multiple million-dollar renovation of a long, crumbling, and neglected building combined with a parade down Del Mar that sort of opened the door to the Loop's expansion eastward beyond Skanker, the Pageant, the Moonrise Hotel, and many other projects in the area.
Yeah. Is there anything before we say goodbye that you would like to add about the Tivoli that we haven't talked about?
Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot in the region these days is walkability and mixed use of property and all that sort of thing. The Tivoli is a good example of something that was built in 1924 right up to the street on a transit line in a diverse area that was growing, and also the kind of property that had a movie theater, storefronts, and apartments above for that sort of live-work matrix that we talk about a lot these days in urban planning.
Well, we thank you, Dale, so much for being with us and bringing us up to speed on a little of the history of the Tivoli.
Thanks for having me.
It certainly is a spot that many of us remember very, very fondly. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
Good to see you. Let's talk about the Fox. Joni, that, I guess, stands out for many other kinds of reasons, basically because of its size and the way it was constructed. This was it was constructed at a time when the movie companies were building their own theaters, much as Anheuser-Busch was building saloons. I mean, you got to have a place for people to go to test your product.
Oh, of course. And again, it's like if you have not gone to one of these venues, you should definitely put it on your list to do because, as I said before, it just adds to the overall experience of the outing and kind of, I think it transforms and elevates the experience overall. And it's definitely something that we're very lucky to have these kind of places close to us, so we can't take advantage of them.
Really, the old style too, Carrie Houck. I remember very, very clearly Stan Kahn coming up from out of nowhere to play the organ.
You know, Mary Strauss tells the story of the first time she and Leon went into the Fox with flashlights and fear. It was in really bad shape. And Mary saw the possibilities, and dear Leon did it for her, and the rest is history. It's a jewel. It's a treasure of our city.
I remember going through it with them at one point years ago, and I certainly can back up what you say. It was it was a mess.
Yeah. I saw the Grateful Dead there, whenever that was, early 70s, late 60s. But it was a much different place then, let me tell you. You really didn't want to put your feet on the floor.
I remember it well. How about you, Cliff? Recollections of the Fox?
Well, I went to St. Louis University in the mid-70s, and the Fox was at its nadir at that point. It was really going through some seriously hard times, and I never really realistically expected it to recover. I thought it would go the way of a lot of the other old movie palaces and neighborhood houses and just be eliminated in some fashion. And so it was really a miracle that somebody like Mary Strauss came along and put the money and time and extreme effort that was required in order to rehab that and bring it back to its former glory.
It really reflects a time that is so different than today. Now when you have these vest pocket size theaters, if you will, and multiple screens and what have you, to think, Joni, of a theater in which you could sit four or 5,000 people to go to the movies. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And that many people would gather in one place to view, this one product. So it's like going to the Muni. It's the same kind of experience. It's an amazing theater experience at the Muni. And, seeing something at these places, it again adds to the overall experience. I grew up in Southwest Missouri. And I remember my mother would drop me off on Saturday afternoons to theater. And this was an old style theater. It had a beautiful balcony, the restrooms were larger than, many places you can actually go today to see a movie. And it was just this wonderful, wonderful theater. And then I went away to college, and I remember my mother telling me they tore it down and turned it into a parking lot. So it's just one of those things where, if you live in the city, you really need to, put it on your list. Go to these places and see them, because it is, like Cliff said, a miracle they're still here.
Well, I don't really think a lot of the kids now understand going to a movie, going to the, we used to call it the picture show, and we would be dropped off at the Ozark Theater. That
Webster
was the
Grove.
One on Lockwood, right?
Right, Webster
the
Webster
Ozark
Groves, yes.
Or the Osage on Kirkwood Road.
Yeah.
And we'd spend the day there. We'd go to church, have lunch, and then they'd drop us off. And then we'd come home and eat dinner.
That's right. See a double feature.
Yeah, every week. Doris Day, beach movies. It's
kind of like the drive-ins. Most of them aren't around anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and we're lucky that we still have these venues.
Yeah. Well, it does reflect a different era, to be sure. I'm just reminded here that another movie theater has just opened up here in Grand Center. The Sun, I guess it's called. It just recently opened up, which is good news.
Right. It's not a movie theater per se. The Grand Center Arts Academy is going to be using that. It's multi-use. We will be showing films actually there to the students during the film festival as part of our Cinema for Students programming. But they'll be doing theatrical presentations, music. It's primarily going to be used by the school itself, but they plan on renting it out for other purposes as well.
Well, I have to take another break. We'll come back and continue talking about the movies and the St. Louis connection. I want to talk about some of the people that are familiar names to all of us who come from St. Louis and made their mark in that particular industry. Back in a moment with Joni Tackett, Carrie Houck, and Cliff Frelick talking about the movies in St. Louis. If you want to get into the conversation, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the movies and St. Louis. And with me in studio here, Carrie Houck, a casting director, Joni Hackett, also a casting director, president of the Missouri Motion Media Association, and Cliff Frelick, who's executive director of Cinema St. Louis. Let's talk about some of the personalities that come from here. I don't know of too many cities, Cliff, I'll start with you on this, that have the kind of representation, high star caliber representation that St. Louis does.
Well, we certainly do have an extraordinary number. It's hard to say that we exceed others because obviously we don't live in those cities, and so we aren't as familiar with who comes from there. We celebrate our natives. And part of, you know, we were talking about Joe Edwards. I think part of that is driven by the Walk of Fame. Mm. We really do pay tribute to the people who come from St. Louis, and we're much more aware, I think, of people from town that have gone on to success. But yeah, we have some truly extraordinary actors who have come from here, both classical Hollywood and contemporary actors, people like Vincent Price and Shelley Winters. Today's stars, you know, you mentioned a few, John Hamm, John Goodman. There's a whole array.
Agnes Moorehead. I got to accept her star on the Walk of Fame. I'll never, ever be able to thank Joe Edwards enough for that. When she was installed, I got to give the speech.
Oh, really? And yeah. What would you say about Agnes Moorehead?
Well, I mean, what a wonderful character actor, actress. I still say actress. It's not politically correct anymore, but I do. And I don't know if she was heralded enough in her lifetime, but boy, I think she was one of the greats. And Shelley Winters, too. You know, a lot of people know Shelley from her stint with Johnny Carson when she'd be interviewed, and she'd be very silly, and they knew her post Poseidon Adventure. But she had a really stellar Hollywood career, and she was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful actress and teacher. I got the chance to study with her a couple of times when she'd come to Wash U. I think Henry Chavez brought her twice for a couple of weeks. And I learned most of what I teach from her. And she was quite a character to boot.
What kinds of things can be taught that she would teach you?
Well, using, you know, she's an actor studio gal, so it was. Your emotional piggy bank, what you have so far, which doesn't really work when you're 20, but when you get to, you know, on in years, middle age, you really can draw from that. And she was a big proponent of method acting. I personally think it comes from different kinds of craft and God-given talent and
endurance,
other things.
Endurance,
yeah.
Too.
But
sticking it out.
She was a wonderful teacher and great with the kids. And one of my favorite Shelley memories, Jill McGuire and I were talking about this the other day because she, the head of the Regional Arts Commission, just announced her retirement.
I saw that, yeah.
And I said, Jill, remember when we went to the opening of King of the Hill and Paul Newman hosted the party? In fact, we sat with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and they didn't engage as much then, but they did later on. But we spent the evening with Shelley Winters and Sylvia Miles, if any of you remember her from Midnight Cowboy and many other films. And it was quite an evening, let me say.
I'll bet it was. But you say that Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward weren't reacting very much to the people around them.
Well, I think, you know, he was such an enormous movie star. And I think he almost had a bubble built around him. He was that famous.
Mm-hmm. And best pals with A.E. Hotchner. There's that mm-hmm. name.
That's one, why he gave
once
the party.
Again. Sure, mm-hmm. sure. Joni, how about you? Thoughts about some of the notables from our area? Anyone come to mind?
Well, I would have to say that every time I watch, you know, Cliff mentioned John Goodman. He's just always perfect, pitch perfect in every character role that he plays. And many times I'm thinking, oh, I really wish John Goodman would bring a movie back here, you know, or some of these people who have left St. Louis would say, I want to bring my project back to St. Louis. That would be a great thing that would happen.
You know, there was a period of time when John Goodman was in every movie that was made for about 10 years. It just seemed like he was in everything. Mm-hmm. He was a very, very busy guy. We've had some calls. Let's bring these folks in and get them into the conversation. Tom joins us from Sunset Hills. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask about George Hickenlooper, St. Louis born and raised director who sadly passed a couple of years ago. His last film, Casino Jack, was with Kevin Spacey. He directed Mick Jagger, Angelica Houston, I think William Hurt, with Billy Bob Thornton. And I wonder if he's eventually headed for our Walk of Fame. And I don't have any, my opinion is entirely biased because we went to high school together. So I wonder what your experts think.
Carrie, you know George.
Oh, I knew George really well.
Yeah.
I met George in Pasadena when he lived in that wonderful historic building, which I'm headed out to for to attend a wedding in a few weeks. But George was my dear friend. He was a very supportive friend. We worked on a number of projects together. And the thing I loved about George was that he had a knack for casting these names in sometimes very low-budget films. And they always said yes. Always said yes.
Well, see, I have a different version because I was wound up on the cutting room floor. Of the big
I'm
restaurant.
Sorry, I remember.
So
that.
I don't think his knack for casting was all that great. He was a wonderful guy. No, I worked with him on a couple of different occasions. Yeah, mm-hmm. He's a great guy.
I think that Joe will honor him one day. That star.
He is a much underrated filmmaker in my estimation as well, and I think his star will ascend over time as people revisit the work. There are a couple of really extraordinary films, like The Man from Elysian Fields, which didn't receive a whole lot of attention at the time. But it is really quite substantial. And Casino Jack, I think, will also stand the test of time. Even Factory Girl, which was sort of derided when it came out, a lot of people who didn't like the portrait of Edie Sedgwick that was presented, I think is really quite an interesting film.
We have an email here from Dale in Crestwood who asks, does the Martinson-Orama Panoramics Theater still exist? Does that ring any bells with anybody?
You stumped me.
Is that the one that was on Lindell?
I have no idea.
That's the Translux Cinerama. Yeah.
He's from Crestwood. I wonder if it's out in that neck of the woods. In any case, sorry, Dale, that we can't help you with that. Let's take another call. Robert is joining us from the Schnooks on Hampton. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm in the Schnooks on Hampton Boulevard. I just wanted to call, first of all, to say I'm a big supporter of St. Louis Radio. Thanks for what you do.
And, thank you for listening.
And you're welcome. And I had a bit part in King of the Hill.
Oh,
and,
which scene?
I was the older golfer.
Oh, that was a great scene. With Craig Hawksley?
Yeah, Craig Hawksley and Adrian Brody and Jesse Bradford were the caddies.
Yeah,
you know?
Dear Adrian.
The delightful experience. I want to tell you something funny about it. My mother, when she watched the film, she said, son, your name was on the screen longer during the credits than you were on the screen during the movie. But I'm still very proud of it, and it was a delight working with Steven Soderbergh and all the others. Just wanted to share my joy that it's coming out on a Blu-ray.
Yes, that's wonderful. Good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You know, I guess it's just testimony to the magic of the movies that anyone who is in one, regardless of what kind of a role they have, and Joni, you're nodding your head, really feels that they've made it somehow or that it's just an extraordinarily extra special time of their life.
Well, I've done a lot of extras casting over the years, and people get very excited about it. And I've worked in a lot of different states around the country, and I've worked in cities. I started out in Baltimore, Washington, and they weren't so excited about it. They were kind of over it because there was a lot of activity that happened there. But I found when I will work on casting, whether it's in Cape Girardeau or whether it's in St. Louis or some state that doesn't get a lot of film activity, people get so excited about it. And I've always been amazed that people who come out and, you know, like 5,000 people came out for the open call for Up in the Air over 2 days. And actually, Jason Reitman came for 3 hours of the open call one day and sat in the back and watched the people come through for the open call. And I was really afraid the media was going to catch him in the background. And then it was going to be just, you know, people were going to say, oh, Jason Reitman's at Crestwood Mall. We have to get there now. But people get really excited about it, and it's a very long day. People don't realize that. I always say it's like jury duty with a chance to be on camera, because you get there really early, you go through the works, and then you sit and you wait to see if you're called, and then you might get called. So people get really excited about it, and that's great for those of us who are doing, you know, extras castings on film. We have to have that excitement, or we're not going to have the people to do the work.
We only have a minute left, Carrie. You still get excited over your role as a gypsy girl?
Yeah, but you know, I had an open call a few weeks ago for the independent film I'm doing, and About 3,000 people came in one morning. It was insane and wonderful. I still get a kick out of that part of it. And a lot of former extras showed up that day, and it was just like a walk down memory lane.
In 30 seconds left, Cliff Frelick, anything you want to leave us with?
I do think that St. Louis does have a pretty significant film background that people perhaps are unaware of. So it's great that you did this show that sort of illuminated a little bit of the hidden corners.
We've had a lot of fun doing it, and there's more to come. I want to thank you all for being
thank
with us.
Thank you, Carrie, and we shouldn't give up.
And no, Joni Tank, thank you, and Cliff Frelick, thank you for being with us. No, we shouldn't give up, and maybe some legislators are listening, but thank you once again. You know, this year marks the 70th anniversary of the film Meet Me in St. Louis. We've talked about that. In celebration of the film, the Missouri History Museum hosted a screening and sing-along of the Judy Garland classic earlier this month. Producer Amanda Hunigfort brought back this audio postcard.
The scene here, it's great. You know, a chance to get out. And enjoy Forest Park, especially with my father and my niece. You know, it's something that three generations can enjoy. As we got in the car, my niece found some change, and she picked up a dime. And I said, don't worry, the movie's free tonight. And she said, it's free? And I said, yeah, we're in St. Louis. Everything's free.
My name is Emily Underwood. I'm the Public Programs Manager at the Missouri History Museum. When we started talking out programs and events for our 250 and 250 exhibit, it was kind of a no-brainer that we needed to make sure to include a screening of Meet Me in St. Louis in some way. And as we sort of chatted about it, we thought there's some songs that are timeless and everybody knows and loves to sing along to. So why not go ahead and feature that as part of the event?
My name is Emily Clark. I had been watching Meet Me in St. Louis since I was a little girl. So when my daughter was born, I knew she was going to love the film as well. So when she was about two, she started watching it, and she fell in love with it, of course, like we all do. And so we decided to come tonight so she could belt out all of her favorite tunes, and she's dressed in her best Tootie tonight.
Nice Cinderella dress.
But we think it looks like Tootie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? And what's your favorite song in Meet Me in St. Louis?
Trolley.
I think it's a great movie for even for kids. You know, it's a nice wholesome movie back when everything was a little bit simpler. She loves the costumes and everything's just, it's really family oriented, which we all are, and I want to instill that in my daughter.
I think it's a great film. It has one of my favorite songs, my favorite Christmas songs, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Every year when it's on the radio and it's not the Judy Garland version, I'm always disappointed because her version, it really makes you feel that family's love of St. Louis and how, you know, they wanted to stay in the city. And when she sings, We'll Have to Muddle Through Somehow, it's very touching, you know, and it's a very emotional song, and I enjoy it.
I like it because they love St. Louis so much, and I love it because
more
that
than New York.
Oh, they New York.
They didn't want to go.
New York has nothing that St. Louis doesn't have. And I just think it's great because they're so loyal to their city and they finally get to stay here and see the fair. How exciting would that have been?
Producer Amanda Huntingfort's audio postcard from the Missouri History Museum screening and sing-along earlier this month of Meet Me in St. Louis. This year marks the 70th anniversary of that film. For more on St. Louis's film history and to see photos of the screening and sing-along, visit stlpublicradio.org. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Beyond Housing President and CEO Chris Kremer about some ongoing challenges in the St. Louis area. May is Stroke Awareness Month. We'll talk about that, especially among women. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.
Whoopsie, if you will meet me in St. Louis.